Tonight, Conway Tard is going to be talking about money and inflation, and we're going to take it in two parts with question period in between. He's first of all going to be looking at Marx and the Marxist view of money, of inflation, and then at the monetarists. So perhaps if we have a question period on Marx's view first, and then go on to discuss monetarism after that. Comrade Hardy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, the subject is money and inflation, and the purpose primarily is to explain Marx's theory of inflation. If this was taking place in the year 1880 instead of 1980, it would be considerably simpler to put it over, because in the 19th century there were a number of economists who more or less took the same view of Marx as to what caused inflation. And students of most economic textbooks in 1880 would have understood what Marx was talking about, even if they didn't entirely agree with it. Well, it's now become very much more difficult. It's become confused. The first reason being the popularization of the theories of the economist John Maynard Keynes, because Keynes brought along with him some fallacious ideas about money and banking. Now, as you know, Keynes is in some disrepute, and a lot of the Keynesians have now become monetarists, like Rees-Mogg, the editor of the Times. But this has only increased the confusion, because the monetarists use language which appears to be the same as the language used by Marx, and that is something entirely misleading. They, for example, say that inflation is a monetary phenomenon due to the money supply being too great. Well, to a superficial view, this looks like Marx's theory. Marx's theory was that the currency is issued in excess, that is, notes and coin, but primarily notes. But in fact, there is no affinity whatever between Marx's view and the view of the monetarists. Marx, as I say, was talking about currency, pound notes, £5 notes, £10 notes, and saying that if you have them issued in excess, you will have inflation, that is, prices will go up. But when Dennis Healy, who was adopting monetarist views 2 years ago, and Mrs. Thatcher say, as they both did, and I quote, "We are not printing money now," they didn't mean they weren't printing notes, because in fact both of them, and it's still continuing, were churning out notes through the Bank of England by the hundreds of millions. What they meant was that they were not borrowing excessively from the banks. I'll deal with this later on, of course. And they both, the monetarists in general, with one partial exception, deny that notes have anything whatever to do with inflation. There is another additional cause of confusion, because the monetarists aren't just one school. To some extent, they differ between themselves. Rees-Mogg, the editor of the Times, who has done more than anybody else to popularise monetarist views in this country in recent years through the Times, has recently discovered Ricardo's labour theory of value, which means, in fact, that Rees-Mogg, so to speak, has broken ranks with some of the other monetarists and has moved a little way towards Marx, because, as you know, Marx's labour theory of value was derived from Ricardo's. It was an improvement on Ricardo's. And Marx based his explanation of inflation on the labour theory of value. And you've got another odd deviation. Milton Friedman, the leading American monetarist, is now riding two horses. He's now saying that inflation is due to two things. First, to the government printing too many notes, just like Marx. But then he ties it up with the statement that it's also due to the banks, the government borrowing too much from the banks. So, as I say, you've got Milton Friedman now riding two horses and confusing the thing more than ever. But the point I want to make here is that the Keynesians and the monetarists both had monetary and banking theories which are completely untenable. The late Professor Cannon, who was not a Marxist but who thoroughly understood inflation, described these theorists as the mystical school of banking theorists, a description that is fully justified and that I'll deal with later. So now I have to say that in order to explain Marx's theory of inflation, I've also got to take in the monetarists and deal with their theory of inflation to show that it has no affinity whatever with Marx's view. Now, as I have said, Marx has based his theory of inflation on his labour theory of value. And as you know, that labour theory of value is that in the production of commodities, a certain amount of labour is required, and that amount of labour measures the relative value of the commodities. If, for example, it requires 1 hour of labour to produce a pound weight of bread, 10 hours to produce a pound weight of silver, and 80 hours to produce a pound weight of gold, then their values will be in the ratio of 1 to 10 to 80. Or to put it the other way around, the value of gold would be 80 times the value of bread. Incidentally, those figures, 1, 10, 80, aren't real ones, but they just give you a broad picture of the sort of relativity. When, therefore, we see that a pound weight of silver sells at a much higher price than a pound weight of bread, and gold sells at a much higher price than a pound weight of silver, what we are really looking at is what is behind the prices, and what is behind the prices is the relative value of these commodities, that is to say, the relative amounts of labour required to produce given quantities of them. Now, in the course of the development of capitalism, the practice grew up of using gold as the money commodity. They tried other things like silver and various other things, but by general consent, in the 19th century, they were all moving towards using gold as the money commodity. Now, in Marx's terminology, gold became the universal equivalent, by which he meant that because all commodities embody value related to the number of hours of labour to produce them, it is possible to use one commodity, and it was gold, as the universal equivalent for all the others. Instead of people having to measure their bread against silver and coal and oil and things like this, they measured all commodities against gold. Gold became the universal equivalent. Therefore, it became the money commodity. Now, I heard recently a BBC alleged financial expert telling his listeners that gold has no intrinsic value. Now, this is, of course, nonsense. It is only because gold has value, like other commodities, that it can operate as the universal equivalent, that is, as the money commodity. Now, it would be theoretically possible to have capitalism operating with a currency consisting solely of gold coins of different sizes and values, with no copper or silver coins, no paper money, but simply gold coins. Now, if such a state existed, it would be necessary to have in circulation as the money commodity a certain total amount of gold, say 100 million ounces, which is something like the amount that was needed in the early part of this century. Suppose you, therefore, you had capitalism running entirely with gold coins and that it totaled about 100 million ounces. What that would mean is that there was a total mass of gold circulating as the money commodity. As population grows and production increases, the needed amount of currency, that is, the needed amount of gold, would increase. And there are various other factors that might operate either to increase it or to decrease it. In the 19th century, in this country actually, the currency consisted of copper and silver coins, gold coins and Bank of England notes. But by law, the copper and silver coins were exchangeable for a fixed amount of gold coins, and the gold coins were exchangeable at a fixed rate with Bank of England notes, and vice versa. You could go with your gold to the Bank of England and demand Bank of England notes at the ratio fixed by the government that 1 pound or sovereign is about 1/4 ounce weight of gold. Or you could go to the Bank of England with your paper money, your Bank of England notes, and demand gold coins for them at the same fixed rate, 1 pound equaled about 1/4 ounce weight of gold. That was the gold standard. And notice this, since the government by law said that the pound, the unit of currency, is about 1/4 ounce weight of gold, it meant that the price of gold was £4 approximately. because each pound, each quarter of an ounce of gold was fixed as the amount of gold in the pound, or as it was called, the sovereign. That was the gold standard as it worked in the 19th century. The Bank of England could only increase its note issue then, above a certain amount, by buying an equivalent amount of gold and stowing it away in the Bank of England vaults. If it put out an additional 10 million of notes, it had to buy 10 million pounds of gold and stick it in Bank of England vaults. So there never could be the situation that exists today where there is no restriction whatever, no formal restriction on the note issue. And while the last Labour government was in office, the Bank of England pushed out an additional about 4,500 million pounds of notes, just printed them and pushed them into circulation on behalf, of course, of the government. The course of the gold standard, for about 100 years before 1914, there was no inflation. The price level in 1914 was actually slightly lower than it was in 1820, and at no point between 1820 and 1914 did the price level rise above the 1820 level. Now contrast that with what, of course, has happened in the last 30 years, where prices have been going up continuously, and the present price level in this country is about 13 times what it was in 1938. There is now, of course, no convertibility of the notes into gold, but there is a relic of the old convertibility. If you look at any of your pound notes, £5 notes, £10 notes, you will read on them, "I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £1. But of course, it's still there, but it doesn't mean a thing. I mean, you think to yourself what it would mean. Suppose you could go to the Bank of England with a pound note and say, "I want a sovereign for this." Your sovereign would be worth about 70 quid. Needless to say, they are not going to give it to you, because although the words are still there, the convertibility has entirely disappeared. I just want to break off here to explain something that I know when I first looked at it I found a lot of difficulty with, and I've no doubt other people do. If you are told that at a given time and in given circumstances a certain total amount of currency needs to circulate, and you try to envisage it, you think there are millions of people today buying things, giving money for them and taking money in shops and betting shops and in banks and all over the place, all this money moving, millions of transactions passing to and from, all of different amounts. And then you try to say to yourself, how do I translate this into the amount of currency that is needed? Well, Professor Cannon, who, as I say, was not a Marxist but understood this business, gave a solution to the problem where he laid down the law: the demand for currency is a demand to hold currency. What Cannon said is, forget all this ungraspable millions of movements going on in the marketplace, and remember that the demand for currency is a demand to hold currency. Now, all of you, as individuals, will be carrying a certain amount of notes and coin with you, and you may possibly have some at home. And if you think, you will know that you're carrying more notes and coin now than you were, say, 10 years ago. And the same is true of every retailer, every betting shop, every railway booking office, particularly, of course, every bank. Now, if there's one thing banks do not want to do, it's to have notes and coin in their tills, because that's a dead loss to them. They want money to be earning them something. So the banks, every day and continuously, are always thinking to themselves, how can we keep to an absolute minimum the amount of notes and coin that we hold? Well, now you've got something you can get hold of. Now think of all the people, individuals and institutions, who are trying to hold as little currency, notes and coin, as they can, but nevertheless find that they must hold a certain amount. Now you can add up the total amounts that people want to hold, and now it gives a sort of meaning to this conception of how much currency is needed at any given time. Now, coming back to Marx's definition of inflation. Marx defined inflation in this sort of way: it's a general price level caused by a depreciation of the currency. Now, depreciation of the currency takes place when it is issued in excess. Suppose, for example, in the 19th century, when there was no inflation, you remember, for practically 100 years, suppose the British government had repealed the law which said that every pound could be converted into a quarter of an ounce weight of gold. Suppose they'd repealed this and said in future there is no convertibility, and they did, at the moment they did it, of course, there was a certain total amount of currency in circulation. Now, the mere fact that that currency, which used to be convertible, the government changes the law and it becomes inconvertible, that does not itself create inflation, because the total amount of currency is unchanged. What causes inflation is an excess, or as Marx put it, if you've had a convertible currency or a totally gold currency circulating of a certain total amount, and the government takes away the convertibility, and then the government doubles the amount of currency in circulation, doubles the amount of paper, inconvertible paper in circulation, then that is inflation. The price level will double. If you double the currency, other things remaining the same, you will double the price level. That is what Marx meant by inflation. In 1938, the total amount of currency in circulation in this country was under 500 million pounds. It is now approaching 10,000 million. Now, of course, you can see why the price level has gone up. In Marxist terms, there has been a continual excess issue of an inconvertible paper currency. It is quite true that production is greater now than it was in 1938, so that the amount of currency people needed to hold would have been more anyway, but of course nothing like the jump from under 500 million to nearly 10,000 million. Now, that's Marx's view of inflation. How do you know, or how can you assume that Marx is correct in giving that view of inflation? Well, the first thing to notice is this, and it's a challenge, so to speak, that's been put for years and years and years. Nobody ever answers it. It is a fact that in the history of capitalism, in this country, on the continent, in America, Russia, everywhere else, whenever there has been an excess issue of currency, in Marxist terms, prices have gone up. And whenever the currency has been curtailed, the excess has been curtailed, prices have stabilized or have gone down. That is a fact. And anybody who disbelieves it, of course, can come along and try to give you, to show you some occasion when it didn't work. Well, nobody has ever come forward and said that they know a time and a place when there was an excess issue of currency and prices did not go up, or the converse of that. Now, that itself is not a proof. And someone who didn't believe it might come along and say, yeah, well, this is just coincidental. Prices and excess issue of currency all go together, but it doesn't prove that the one causes the other. They may say, it doesn't prove that one causes the other because there is some third cause that operates on all these occasions. Very good, I mean, it's fair enough. But then, of course, they've got to tell you what this other cause is. And, of course, they will give you dozens of answers. The first answer they give you is that inflation is caused by wage increases. So let's have a look at it. Between 1850 and 1914, wages, real wages, went up by 90%. So those people who believe that inflation is caused by rising wages will be able to say, well, of course, prices ought to have gone up by at least 90% between 1850 and 1914, but they didn't go up at all. So that's the first objection disposed of. The second popular objection is that prices go up because of greed of manufacturers, retailers, bankers, and so on. All right? Prices now are 13 times what they were in 1938 because of the greed of all these people. But are we to believe that they weren't greedy in the 19th century when prices didn't go up? Or take the Swiss. Swiss has a much lower rate of inflation than this country. For about 3 years running, it only went up 1% in Switzerland. Are we to believe that the gnomes of Zurich are not greedy like their English counterparts? Obviously, a piece of nonsense, so you cannot explain inflation by alleged greed. You had a variation of this in Peregrine Warsthorne, who said that inflation was due to the spirit of evil. Well, I mean, here again, since when has evil, in his religious sort of terms, only existed in this country since 1938 and didn't exist in the 19th century? One odd explanation of inflation is used by the Communist Party on occasion, who say that it's due to armament expenditure. Well, of course, they do not explain why armament expenditure in the 19th century didn't also lead to inflation. A rather more difficult argument is the one that the last government and the present government and the city editors all use. They say inflation in this country has been caused by the oil-producing countries banding together four or five years ago and doubling and trebling the price of oil. They say because the oil-producing countries have put up the price of oil, this has compelled inflation to happen in Britain and other countries. Well, let's have a look at this. Suppose this had happened in the 19th century when there was no inflation because the note issue was restricted by the gold standard. In those circumstances, if you had got the price of oil doubling and trebling, or any other commodity doubling or trebling, what would have been the result? Since people's incomes, when there's no inflation, are not automatically increasing every month and every year by an increase in the note issue, if the price of oil went up, people would either have to buy less oil, or if they bought the same quantity of oil as before and therefore had to pay more for it, they'd have to spend less on everything else, or a mixture of both. So that what in fact would happen in those circumstances, if there was no inflation because the note issue was restricted, and if oil prices went up, oil prices would go up, but other prices would go down and there would be no effect on the general price level. In other words, the rise in prices since the OPEC countries put up their oil prices has not been due to them putting up the oil prices. It has been due to the fact that all the governments of Europe, including the present, the British government, have been busily printing and putting into circulation additional notes. There is another argument that inflation takes place because government expenditure is too high. And what they mean when they say that government expenditure is too high, they mean that government expenditure is high in relation to the total national national income. Enoch Powell uses this argument, but if you look up Enoch Powell's book of his collected speeches, you will find a footnote where he says, I know the argument isn't really true. He says what he really means is that if governments spend too much, they are always tempted to go in for inflation. But he knows it is not true, because if the government raised all its revenue by taxation, it doesn't matter whether they raise a lot by taxation and spend a lot, or whether they raise a little by taxation and spend a lot, you would not have inflation. If it were true, of course, that government expenditure causes inflation, you would get the odd situation that as government expenditure relatively declined, inflation would decline, but in fact you don't find it doing so. But it is nevertheless true, Enoch Powell's quite true here, that in recent years you've had government increasing their expenditure quite rapidly, but it isn't that that's caused inflation. It is the fact that instead of raising the money by taxation, they've been raising it by printing more notes. Another alleged cause of inflation is that production is too low. Now here again, if low production caused inflation, in the years 1968 to 1973, production increased by 13%. It was a period of quite rapid growth of production. Well, according to their theory, as production increased rapidly in those years, production ought to have lessened. But in fact, in those years, prices went up by 45%. And make a comparison with 1938 or with 1951. Since 1951, production in this country has more than doubled. In 1951, production was very low. Well, according to this theory that low production causes inflation, prices ought to have been higher in 1951 than they are now, because production has been largely increased since 1951. I want to have a look at the way the Labour Party and the Tory Party have dealt with inflation. It has been caused in the last 30 years by both Labour and Tory governments acting on the principle that if the government printed and circulated excess notes, that this would enable them to cure unemployment and various other things. But in fact, neither the Tories nor the Labour Party have really understood what they were doing. While they've been increasing government expenditure, they have not, and have been printing more notes, they haven't understood that it is the printing of the notes that has caused the inflation. You will get them and individuals like Sir Keith Joseph and the Radcliffe Committee on Monetary, the Monetary System, 1959, flatly denying that printing notes has anything whatever to do with inflation. So far as the Tories and Labour Party have had any policy at all, it has been that although they were causing inflation by printing notes but not understanding it, they were both of them trying to hold down prices by an incomes policy. Well, as you know, there has been a complete failure. While the last Labour government was in office, 5 years, 1974 to 79, while they were professing to be fighting inflation, they did, in fact, double the cost of living. But now, in recent years, first Callaghan and Healey in the Labour Party, and now a lot of the Tories, have come to recognise that you can't cure unemployment by the government spending more, which was a specific belief of the Labour Party at their conference in 1944. They laid down the proposition, if general unemployment threatens, you must give people more money to spend. But although they were saying this and have done it, they still didn't understand that it was this that has caused inflation. They didn't associate the inflation that was going on with the fact that they were printing more and more notes. But you can just look at the argument itself about government expenditure increasing production and therefore reducing unemployment. Between 1969 and 1978, government expenditure went up from 13,000 million to 51,500 million. In other words, it was multiplied by four. Now, according to that Labour Party and early Tory theory, if government expenditure goes up so that it is four times as great, production ought to have been left up like it. But in fact, production grew hardly at all. And it ought to have reduced unemployment. But unemployment didn't fall. It went up from 580,000 in 1969 to over 1.5 million in the late 1970s. All that it did was to cause prices to rise. There are one or two difficulties that I would briefly refer to before leaving Marx's theory of inflation, and they are these. First of all, don't think that Marx is saying if the note issue increases, prices will go up. He's not saying that prices will go up because the note issue increases. He's saying that prices will go up if the note issue is issued in excess, which is not the same thing as a mere increase. Because if production, for example, is rapidly growing, the necessary amount of currency will itself be growing. So what would be an excess at a lower level of production is not an excess at a higher level of production. But it is not the increase, it is the excess that is the factor. Now, this is different from the monetarist theory. Sir Keith Rees-Mogg, rather, of the Times, lays down his monetarist theory in the terms that if the money supply goes up by 10% this year, prices will rise perhaps 18 months or 2 years later by 10%. I'm going to deal with this later. But you'll notice the difference between the monetarist theory, which is merely growth of the money supply, and Marx's theory, which is an excess of the paper, inconvertible paper currency. Between 1820 and 1914, for example, there was a continuous or almost continuous increase in the currency. But it didn't put up prices because the currency only increased with production itself and was therefore not in excess. You want to notice, by the way, that while inflation is a general rise of prices due to a depreciation of the currency, it is not the only kind of general rise of prices. Marx also pointed out that in a boom, prices always go up. And in the depression, prices always go down. And in that period from 1820 to 1914, prices never rose above the 1820 level, that they went down in depressions and they went up in booms within a range of about 25% each way. So you have to remember that you can have a cyclical movement of prices up and down, which has nothing to do with inflation, but is due to booms and depressions. Another point to notice is the question of the gold reserve. It is true, in the 19th century under the gold standard, the Bank of England had to maintain a gold reserve. Incidentally, it never had to have enough gold to cover the whole of its note issue, because it was allowed to issue some of its notes without gold backing. But nevertheless, it had a gold reserve always there. And the idea has grown up in some people's mind that it is the gold reserve that maintains the value of the note issue. This is quite wrong. It isn't the gold reserve that maintains the value of the note issue. It's the convertibility into gold at a fixed rate. You could run a gold standard, not with a very large amount of gold, as the Bank of England did, but with quite a small one, for the simple reason that once people have it in their idea that a Bank of England note is as good as gold, they don't want the gold. They'd much rather carry Bank of England notes. It's only when they begin to have doubt about it that people want to go to the bank and say, here's my paper, I want gold for it. So you would have only needed in the 19th century a much smaller gold reserve than they actually had. On the other hand, the existence of a big gold reserve without convertibility means nothing at all, although many governments at different times have gone to enormous expense to build up huge gold reserves without convertibility in the belief that by having a gold reserve, their currency would maintain its value. But if there's no convertibility, they're wasting their money on maintaining a gold reserve. It serves no purpose at all. Switzerland, for example, has a gold reserve much larger than its total note issue. If the Swiss wanted to, they could, so to speak, call in all their paper and issue gold in its place. But this does not. But as they have not got convertibility in Switzerland now at a fixed weight of gold, their gold reserve serves no useful purpose. At least it doesn't serve that purpose. It serves no purpose in relation to preventing inflation. And in fact, though it's a very small rate, the Swiss are now running something like 3 or 4% inflation. And their huge gold reserve does not prevent it. Again, remember, it is not the existence of a gold reserve, large or small, that prevents inflation. It is the restriction of the note issue. And you could restrict the note issue without having any gold reserve at all, and without even having any convertibility. You simply restrict the note issue. As happened in December 1919, when the Treasury issued a minute to the Bank of England saying, print no more notes. And the Bank of England had to carry it out. They stopped adding to the note issue. And within months, prices were coming down. And the same thing could be done now. They could run, so to speak, an effective non-inflation policy without having any gold reserve, provided they have some mechanism by which the note issue was restricted. The last point here on this first part of it is to remind you that Marx was saying that capitalism can be run with inflation or without. Marx wasn't expressing any particular preference to it. He just drew attention to what the problems were. Marx was not saying, and neither do we, that the workers would be better off if there was no inflation. There was no inflation in the 19th century, and all the problems that the workers have to face now, they had to face then, with one exception. In the 19th century, if the workers got a wage increase, it was a real wage increase, because they were dealing with a stable price level. So when, as I said before, wages went up by 90% between 1850 and 1914, that was a little over 1% a year, this sort of thing, the workers were getting that much better off out of the increased production of capitalism. Since 1938, in the last 30-odd years when we've had continuous inflation, workers have got the illusion that they're getting great wage increases. But in fact, the real increase in wages has only been going on in the last 30, 40 years at much the same rate that it was in the 19th century. You can have a case in point. As you know, the miners recently put in a claim for 65% pay increase. They settled for 20. And all they will really get out of it, when you've allowed for prices and for the effect of PAYE, they'll get perhaps 1 or 1.5% out of it. This is all they will get. In other words, the workers are living in a great world of illusion as regards this. And the last point of all, is it possible that the Thatcher government, even without understanding it, will eventually succeed in halting inflation? Well, it is a possibility. And for this reason, it may sound odd to say that a government can achieve a certain result without knowing what they're doing, except, as I've already pointed out to you, the Labourites who ran the inflation policy in the last 30 years also didn't know what they were doing. And it's equally possible for the Tories to run an anti-inflation policy without knowing how they get there. And the way it could happen is this. In addition to saying that they are monetarists, the Tories want to go back to the situation in which there is a balanced budget. In other words, they want to cut government expenditure so that the government spends no more than the income it raises by taxation. Now, if they got to a point where the government had got a balanced budget, where they were only raising the same, spending the same amount that they were raising by taxation, and therefore having no possibility of raising some revenue by printing notes, they would in fact bring inflation to an end, even if they didn't understand it. What the prospects are of their doing is, of course, another matter. Now, having got to the end of that part of it, I want in the next half to deal with with monetary theory and so on. But at the moment, you may like to ask some questions about the Marxist part of it.
There's you mentioned about the armaments in the 19th century and the armaments today. The armaments, what is today, 19th century, can't be compared to it anyway. A lot more.
No, but this wasn't the communist argument. The communist arguments say that armaments, by their very nature as armaments, cause inflation. Incidentally, if you were to say to the Communist Party, as the Russians spend an enormous amount of armaments, is there enormous inflation in Russia? The communists would immediately say no. They would say this only happens in England. But the argument itself is false. Armament expenditure is no different from any other expenditure, as far as the effect on inflation is concerned. Inflation is caused by an excess issue of an inconvertible paper currency. Whether you're spending some of it on armaments or not, doesn't matter.
At the back.
Yes.
What is that connection between the low issue and the rising class?
Well, you mean how does it operate?
Yes.
Well, it's like this. When the government, through the Bank of England, prints and puts into circulation additional notes, like the 4,500 million that he did when he was Chancellor, this money is credited to the government account. It is money the government is going to spend. Well, you think to yourself, here is 4,000 million of additional money coming into the market to buy things. In effect, it's additional money, you see, that has cost the government nothing except the cost of the paper and printing. Here's the additional money coming in the market to buy things. Naturally, it puts prices up. And if you think to yourself, this is quite obvious, you think to yourself of holiday resorts in the holiday season. In the holiday season, thousands of people move into holiday resorts with money to spend. And you know what happens in the summer season at holiday resorts? The price of everything goes up. Price of hotels, boarding houses, restaurants, everything goes up. In the winter, when these people move out again, the prices go down again. But you can see the point. You bring new money into a particular market, additional money, up go prices. It becomes a seller's market.
And pressure of demand.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a demand that is not reflected in any increase in supply. It's simply additional money.
Allowing for the fact, you see, that the issue of notes is more than the market can bear, isn't it a fact, you see, that you can, you see, and it's proved that there are illustrative points, you know, where if you can get somebody to accept your depreciation of currency, you do ride it, don't you? I mean, we in this country have, you know, in the past, you know, through paying, the Arab countries, you know, and depreciation of currency, which they don't accept now. You say they want it, you know, in a different form. Don't they ride the economy as a result?
Well, I mean, do you mean that, of course, for a long time, the Americans and the British were buying oil in the Middle East with depreciating currency. And eventually the oil-producing countries got together and said, enough of this. We're either going to be paid in gold or we're going to put up our prices. But, I mean, if that's what you mean, this is the answer. They were foolish not to have started from their point of view, if not having started it earlier.
Yeah, but is it the only exception? You know, are the Swiss in that dominating position at the present time to do the very same?
Eh? Are who?
The Swiss.
Well, I mean, the Swiss, like the British government, can run an inflationary policy if they want to, or not run an inflationary policy. I mean, in this country, from 1914 to 1919, prices were rocketing out. They were running an inflationary policy. They set up the Cunliffe Committee, and the Cunliffe Committee reported on inflation, said what you want to do is to stop the issue of note issue. And the Lloyd George government then did as I said. They got the Treasury to write to the Bank of England and say, print no more notes. They ran an inflation policy for 5 years, and then they decided to end it. The British government could do it now, if they wanted to. But you see, you've now got this Keynesian influence that's been behind them all, and they don't want to end it. They don't want to start reducing government expenditure and cutting things down. But they could have, there's nothing to prevent them if they want to, if they had the will to do it. And, of course, if they understood what they're doing. But you've got this additional fact that, so to speak, there was much clearer understanding of inflation 50 or even 100 years ago than there is now. You've got a lot of people brought up by universities in recent years who only know the Keynesian stuff and who therefore don't understand inflation at all.
Yes.
Marx, through his theory of value, came to a conclusion that gold was the universal equivalent after having gone through a simple form of exchange, an accidental form of exchange, a general form of exchange, converting itself into the money form. Well, coming to that conclusion, he then says that gold had a dual personality or a dual purpose. It was the measure of value and it was the standard of price. Standard of price, a fixed rate of gold, that in terms of weight, standard of price shows itself in weight. The measure of value shows itself in a certain amount of socially necessary labour time, social hours. While I was wondering, with the antics of gold today, whether it has lost one side of its personality, that is, as a standard of price, where you see gold one day $500 an ounce, and then probably within 2 or 3 days it's $600 an ounce, and within a week could be $800 an ounce. See, I would think if gold is going to take on a standard and a fixed rate of gold, meaning an arbitrary, a given amount of money, then with that sort of erratic movement, I think that has spoiled that definition. So can you get the point now?
Well, to start with, you see, Marx, it wasn't Marx, so to speak, who made gold a standard value, it was capitalism. Made gold their universal equivalent. Marx, in describing inflation, was in fact describing British capitalism. They had reached it, you see. And Marx says the reason why gold was a very useful universal equivalent, a money commodity, was because gold is not an absolutely stable commodity, but a relatively stable one. The conditions of producing gold don't change rapidly. It is quite true, late in the 19th century, the amount of labour required to produce an ounce of gold was falling. Not very much, but it had the effect of putting up prices. And incidentally, I should say something about that, as I will in a moment. But all the countries, or almost all the countries in the world, no longer have a convertible paper currency. So the value of gold no longer has any relation whatever to the price level. It's quite divorced from it. There is no gold reserve behind the British currency. You can't convert it. They've even taken it away, so to speak. The Bank of England no longer has a gold reserve at all. The price level has risen because notes have been issued in excess. But look at it from the other point of view. The value of gold hasn't changed at all, or at least changed very little since 1938. So to speak, if you got the price level multiplied by 13 since 1938, you would expect if the value of gold hasn't changed, you would expect the price of gold to multiply by 13 times as well. But what you're noticing is that the price of gold has multiplied by much more than 13 times. Well, this is due to the speculative element, because all over the world there are governments, the American government in particular, the Chile government, the Argentine government, and the British government, the Italian government, all depreciating their currency, and the French government, all over the world, I should throw in India as well, all over the world there are people trying to get out of paper. They're saying, look, the purchasing power of paper money is going to go on falling. We want to protect ourselves against this. And they've tried all sorts of things. They've bought paintings, they've bought the junk you see in the junk shops, they've bought commodities. And the one thing that for 100 years or more people have been buying when they want a hedge against inflation is gold. So people have been buying gold because they're afraid of paper money is losing its purchasing power. They're buying it as a safeguard. So they're all speculating. They're not paying a price for gold which is the current value of gold. They're paying a price for gold which assumes, look, if inflation's going on at 20% this year, 30%, 40%, I would be wise not to pay the current price, which is the current value of gold, but to price something everything more, to buy myself into 5 years ahead. That's why the price of gold has rocketed up. It's speculation. The people are buying against what they fear may happen in the future. Now, if you want that to end, and Marx dealt with this, and other people, even other economists have dealt with it, if you get to a point where the leading countries of the world agree to stabilize their paper money and stop printing it in excess, then all these people who've been buying gold at speculative prices will be rushing out trying to sell it again, and the price of gold will come down to something like its value. I should, of course, have referred to the possibility of returning to a gold standard. Rees-Mogg is advocating it. He wants to return to the gold standard like the 19th century one, but he's wise enough to realise it would be ridiculous to go back to the 19th century, £1 equals a quarter ounce of gold, because that at the present moment, that would be £1 note is worth 70 quid, which would be absurd. What Rees-Mogg would propose, which would be sensible, would be to go back to stabilise the currency at something like the present level, and then keep it under control with the gold standard. Of course, as I've already pointed out, what he wants to achieve is to prevent an excess issue of paper money, and you can achieve that just as well, of course, without a gold standard, simply by restricting it. Though it requires some method of doing it.
Can I just bring that up on that? The Bank of England doesn't have any gold reserves.
No. It was taken away from the Bank of England and handed over to the Exchange Equalisation Fund, which also is run by the Bank of England, but it's not in the Bank of England banking department. If you look at the Bank of England accounts, you'll see nothing now about gold. In other words,
why are these great fortresses all over the world protecting this gold?
Oh, well, they want the gold. They're going to give it away. But I mean,
they must be aware then of
no value. Oh, it's highly valuable. I mean, gold is £70 an ounce. You can't say that's not valuable. Oh no, they buy it for all sorts of reasons. One thing, I mean, the Russians, for example, are big gold producers. They have an enormous gold reserve somewhere. And incidentally, if you disclose where it is, you're liable to be shot in Russia, as a good old capitalist country, and attach a lot of importance to this. But they need it when Russia has a harvest failure and want to spend £100 million buying wheat in America or somewhere. The Americans aren't going to take ruble notes. In effect, the Russians have to pay in gold. That's the sort of thing. And every government wants a gold reserve for wartime. You see, in wartime and other things, in wartime, nobody may be going to take your paper notes at all. I mean, the oil-producing countries have already, some of them said they won't take paper dollars or paper pounds. They want gold, and they want gold for this sort of reason. Oh, but gold hasn't lost its value. It is no longer convertible into the currency, which is as it was in the 19th century.
Yes.
So
Why did they stop the gold standard? Why did they give it up?
Well, they gave it up for two reasons. One, that they were dissatisfied with the way capitalism worked. And some people came along and said, you know, what's wrong with capitalism? Nothing wrong with capitalism. It's just having a gold standard that's bad for it. So you had certain individuals, Ernest Bevin, the Labour leader, was one, who advocated inflation and did know what he was talking about, by the way. And the banker, who was the leader of the Chartist movement, Attwood, a leading banker, led the Chartist movement. He was an advocate of inflation in the 19th century. And remember, inflation is good for some people and bad for others. Keynes wrote about this. Keynes pointed out that inflation is good for borrowers and bad for lenders. See, if you're a borrower, by which he meant the industrial capitalist class, you borrow £1 million this year, and you have to pay your million back in 5 years' time, but you pay it back in depreciated currency. So inflation is good for borrowers and bad for lenders. It's the lenders who lose by inflation. So you've got one lot of people saying, look, capitalism would run better if we did have inflation. Others, and this is much more important, others saying, not let's have inflation, but saying let's have Keynes, let's have the government spending a lot more money, then we won't have any unemployment. This was the major reason why they went in for it, because they believed that by increasing government expenditure they could increase production and have no unemployment. And it's only, you see, experience has taught them that it is wrong. And Keynes' particular part in it was, Keynes in his book he published in 1923 on monetary reform laid down the proposition that he had been won over to the idea that it was no longer necessary to maintain any formal control over the note issue, by which he didn't mean that he wanted the note issue to be increased in excess. He just thought that you no longer needed to have formal control over it. Well, this was a view that a whole lot of economists and politicians accepted from Keynes. So this is the real reason why the major reason why they gave it up, was because they would be won over to Keynes' ideas. And this is the major reason why a lot of Tories are now abandoning it, because they've seen it didn't work. And they now think that they can find a salvation in monetarism, which they couldn't find in Keynesism.
Jim?
Yeah. Did Marx have anything to say about the way the currency circulates?
Anything that was stable? Well, it was stable in which sense?
I mean, a set amount of currency, did that circulate at a set speed, or could it...
Oh, no. Oh, he was quite familiar with all the arguments about changing velocity of circulation.
And what did he say?
Well, I mean, what everybody else says, that it varies at different times.
And that would explain the rising price levels in booms and depressions.
Well, I mean, as he put it, very, very effectively, by the way, he said that in a depression, the capitalist is in need of cash. And what was his phrase? He pants for cash as the heart pants for the water brook or something out of the Bible. In other words, he's trying to get hold of money at any price. He will go to a bank and borrow and pay fantastic rates of interest for it, or he will flog his goods in the market below their value in order to get some cash. Whereas in a boom, the capitalist doesn't want cash, he wants goods. So he's then rushing in the market trying to buy raw materials and things.
He's preparing for a depression, mother.
Pardon?
He collects the goods, preparing for the next depression.
Well, no, he's doing it because he hopes to make a profit out of it. See, as capitalism is expanding and moving towards a boom, the capitalist can now see that if he doesn't get in quickly, his rivals will get in first and get all the available material as it is. You see, in the last boom in this country, autumn of 1973, while there were a number of companies saying they were working below capacity because they hadn't gotten any orders, there were nearly half the companies at that time saying they were working below capacity because, at least they were unable to meet, they had so many orders they were unable to meet them. They were short of goods, they were short of skilled workers, and among the odd things they were short of was steel. Autumn 1973, they couldn't get steel at any price. There was a shortage of it. Now, of course, they've got about, 15 million tonnes too much or something like this.